This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and what, for me, on a personal level, has been a satisfying completion of unfinished business. Ever since my friend Bill McLeod told me about his brave bombardier, Duke O'Donnell, a decade ago, I've wanted to meet this man. I'm sorry it took me so long, but I'm also reminded that God's timing is always better than mine. We've heard the story of Duke's Purple Heart in his words and also through the memories of his late pilot, but the ordeal wasn't over when the plane touched back down in England. What about his recovery from the blinding wounds of that plexiglass exploding in his face and the nose of that B-17 on the last day of 1944? So they get you down, you're treated in the hospital. At what point were you able to see again, and was there some time where you thought, hey, I don't know if I'll ever see again?
Well, I never thought about not seeing again, but as I recall, well, they took me to the hospital, and when they took the glass out, I could see. I think it was quite sore, but I was able to see then, yeah.
And I imagine that has to be a pretty good feeling, that maybe you appreciate your sight a little more after you've lost it for a while.
Yeah, of course, that was the same day, so I wasn't, I didn't know what I was doing. Really. Next day, I appreciated it, yeah.
And I know I'm bouncing around a little bit here, but again, you're just 19 years old at the time. You knew this was dangerous work before you got into it. In your heart of hearts, did you think you'd be coming home? Did you think you were going to see America again?
No, I tell you, the first few weeks there, we were losing planes. Well, we were losing like at least one plane a mission. We had to fly 35 missions, and we put up 39 planes. So I figured, well, my chances of getting back are 4 out of 39. They aren't very good. So I didn't think I was going to make it. I thought that's only a matter of days or weeks or months at the most, and I'm done for. So I didn't think I was going to get back, but I did.
And it almost sounds like you were resigned to that fact. Was that a patriotic thing? Was that something from your faith? Or what do you think enabled you to keep doing what you were doing, knowing that there was a good chance you wouldn't come back?
Well, I think you're trained to do it. You feel it's your obligation to do it. Your friends are doing it. You do it too.
And then after you survive all that, you said it was only a few weeks before you were back in the air again?
Mm-hmm, right, yeah, flying.
Was that hard? Were you, I mean, after you go through something like that?
I tell you, the first mission after I got hit, I was scared stiff, I tell you. About every 30 minutes, the bombardier takes an oxygen check because we had oxygen masks on. And so I remember saying, when the flak started, I tried to say over the intercom, oxygen check, nothing came out. I was so scared.
You couldn't utter a sound.
No, but that was what we called a milk run, a real easy mission. No fighters and not too much flak. But the next one, that had been the next mission I flew, I don't know what would happen, because the briefing officer before the mission said there were 350 flak guns down there. And they had, as I say, several ways of firing it, but one was box flak, they called, and they put everything they had up in the sky in the same place at the same time, and 350 artillery shells going off at the same place in the sky at the same time is quite a spectacle, and that happened in front of us in the next mission, and if that had been the one previous.
And what did happen there? Because it sounds like I guess maybe an analogy would be you're going through a cheese grater or a paper shredder.
Yeah. We had a lot of damage that time to the ship, I know.
And when you're about to fly through it, and you're the guy in the front of the plane in that nose, do you close your eyes this time? Do you duck your head? What do you do?
No, you can't close your eyes or duck your head. You have to watch out for enemy fighters and watch out for the target, and you know, beyond your best there, yeah.
So what does that sound like when you fly through that cloud of flak?
Well, by that time, the flak is all gone, and there's a lot of smoke left. But
you said you had a lot of damage, so I'm...
When it went off, we got the damage. I mean, you know, when it explodes, that's when we get the damage.
So you hear a little rat-a-tat-tat?
No, you don't seem to hear any. Of course, we had earmuffs, to hear the intercom system, so...
And you mentioned enemy fighters, but if I have it right, you guys in your crew and in that group for the most part, had it pretty fortunate because you had a little help when it came to enemy fighters, right?
Oh, yeah, we had P-51, little friends, we call them. They helped us out, yeah.
So you mentioned that you had those three missions, you get hurt, you fly a couple more, and then they took you for this special training with the GH system, with the different radio frequencies, and the intersection of those frequencies becomes your target. So did that require some special training for you? Were there some tough things for you to pick up? What did you have to learn?
Well, you had to practice flying over England and practice missions using the GH. And yeah, it wasn't a lot of training, but there was a certain amount of it.
And then you went and flew some more missions with that technology. What do you remember about those missions?
Well, one I do remember in particular, we had this plane came right at us, a German fighter, and I didn't realize then they had any jets. But I tried to train the guns on the guy, and he flew right past. He came so fast I couldn't get the guns trained on him, but he didn't fire on us. So, and I couldn't figure it out. So, but after the war, I found out that the Germans did have a 262 or 263 jet, and there was one of those. And I heard at that time Hitler had said they weren't operational yet, so they don't fire on anybody. So which probably saved our lives.
Yeah.
If they had, because they came right as they could have shot us down without any trouble at all.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have been able to hit him flying at that speed unless you got really lucky.
Well, I couldn't get the guns trained up at him in time. Mm-hmm. It was so fast, it was closing speed of like probably 800-900 miles an hour because those jets were... But I'd never seen anything like that before.
No one ever had. And another reason for you and your family to be thankful when it's all said and done. Speaking of that, VE Day, what do you remember about that? Was that a memorable day for you and your bomb group?
Well, I was on leave that day. I was in London. And we used to get 2 days leave a month. And then we heard that we got two extra days because the war is over. So... I was in London, somebody said Churchill's going to come out of that building over there. So I stuck around and for a while and didn't come out. But Montgomery, Monty, came out. I saw him, Field Marshal Montgomery, head of the English Army. So, but I never did see Churchill come out.
But that had to be a pretty neat place to be because London had been bombed so much throughout this war, and now victory is won. I bet there are a lot of excited people around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And London was a real desolate place, almost, parts of it. There would be like blocks after blocks leveled, just nothing but rubble. In fact, they take maybe 8 or 9 blocks and take all the rubble off and pile them up in one block. Make a huge pyramid of just old stone and the remains of buildings, rubble, really something to see.
So now that the war is over, I bet you wanted to come home.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, first we thought we'd be going to the Pacific because the war in the Pacific was still going on. So we went to Liverpool and got in a cement boat. When I say cement boat, I don't mean they carried cement. It was made out of cement. There were a few of them like that. And so we left Liverpool for Boston, and we got out about halfway across the ocean. The war in the Pacific ended. So it took 13 days to come because we broke down, I guess, about half one day and drifted backwards toward England. That's how I got it. And then they ran out of food at the end, too. But by that time, we didn't care because the last day, all we had to eat was ice cream.
Some people wouldn't complain about that. But after everything you've been through and almost killed in the air, that would be just your luck to be lost at sea in a cement boat going backwards. Was that emotional or memorable for you to set foot on American soil again?
Well, it was nice. I don't call it memorable, but to get home was good again, yeah.
And you had a life to get on with, so you took advantage of the GI Bill. You went to the University of Notre Dame, even got to see one of the greatest college football games ever played?
Yeah, the Army-Notre Dame game of 1946, supposed to be about the best game ever played. Nothing-to-nothing tie. The Army got down to our 3-yard line once but couldn't make it across. But they gave the game to... Notre Dame because they had more first downs than Army. Well, there was a nothing-to-nothing tie, but in the rankings, they came out ahead of Army.
And you were there in New York City for that game with Glenn Davis and Doc Blanchard on the other team.
Right. They were there, too.
Who was Notre Dame star? Was it Johnny Lujack?
Johnny Lujack, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
So Davis, Blanchard, and Lujack, that's your 1945, 46, and 47 Heisman Trophy winners all in the same game, yet nobody scored a point. There's something that's never going to happen again. And for this audience, perhaps it's of interest that all three of those Heisman winners served in the military. Before Johnny Lujack won the Heisman at Notre Dame, he served 2 years in the Navy. He finished as an ensign, and among the highlights of his service was patrolling the English Channel in search of German submarines. Glenn Davis, the 1946 Heisman winner and Mr. Outside at West Point, he spent 3 years on active duty in the Army before playing pro football. And Doc Blanchard, Mr. Inside, and the 1945 Heisman winner, had enlisted in the Army in 1943, trained with a chemical warfare unit in New Mexico before receiving his appointment to West Point. And after his athletic exploits, he became an Air Force fighter pilot, eventually retiring as a colonel. Doc Blanchard flew 113 missions during the Vietnam War. Just a little context for you with regard to that game Duke O'Donnell witnessed at Yankee Stadium in New York in November of 1946. And that's almost 70 years ago, but here you're still going strong. You're still driving. You're still volunteering at the church. Tell me about that. You've been out here in Southern California for less than a decade, but you already found a way to get involved.
Yeah, we, some friends of mine, we go door to door. We say we're from St. Elizabeth Catholic Church in the corner of Elgin and El Fuerte. We go through the neighborhood welcoming people to the church and taking a short survey. And then we say, may we ask if anyone in the household baptized Catholic? And if they say yes, and if they're not going every week, we give them some literature and urge them to go. If they're not going to any church, we have some literature for them. It works out pretty good.
Why do you do that?
Well, I'm either going up or down here pretty soon, you know. I want to go to the right place. And the guy's been good to me, as you can tell, and so I figure I'd pay him back a little bit, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Well, and he has been good to you, and I don't want to put your words in your mouth, but when I go back to New Year's Eve in 1944, I get the feeling that you think he was there with you.
Well, he must have been. Yeah, I go along with that, agree with you.
You know, and I made the comment, your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids would be glad you didn't jump out those Bombay doors like you contemplated in the PTSD stupor of after getting hit in the face. Have you ever thought about that and pondered the fact that none of those people would be here if you didn't survive that mission in the war?
Well, you're right, they wouldn't. Yeah, God's good.
It's been a long time since World War II. Most people today weren't alive during World War II. Most of us were not alive and don't really know what it was like. So what do you think is the most important thing we need to know today about you and those 16 million other Americans who put on a uniform in World War II?
Well, we were just doing our duty.
Are you proud of what you did?
Well, I'm glad I did it. I wouldn't say I'm proud of it, but I went along with it, you know.
Well, I'm proud to know you, and I want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us a little bit of your story. Is there anything we left out? Anything else you think we need to know?
What about Hermann Göring?
Yeah, so people recognize that name as the head of the Luftwaffe, but someone of that same name was in your bomb group, in your squadron?
Yeah, he was supposed to be a nephew of, he was with us. He was a hot pilot bombing the Germans.
And I don't know if it's verified or not, but is it true that there was someone on his plane that was put there to keep an eye on him, make sure his allegiance was to the U.S.?
I think that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. Since he was a relative, yeah.
Well, that's one I had to look up. So after talking to Duke about it, I did some quick research and learned there's now a book about that very topic. You'll find a link if you go to hometownheroesradio.com. The book is called Hell Above Earth, The Incredible True Story of an American World War II Bomber Commander and the Co-Pilot Ordered to Kill Him. It tells the story of Werner Göring, who was in the 303rd Bomb Group with Duke, and yes, indeed, was the nephew of the head of Nazi Germany's Luftwaffe. Werner served honorably in the war, even earning the Distinguished Flying Cross. And it also tells the story of Jack Wrencher, who was assigned to Werner's crew with instructions to take him out if he proved to be disloyal. Yet another example of how many incredible stories are out there if we just take the time to talk to our veterans before it's too late. We're out of time on today's program. Don't forget to find photos and video of Duke O'Donnell at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And if you're anywhere near the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California on October 21st, get there around 5:30 and welcome home about 70 World War II veterans from their honor flight to Washington, D.C. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.